Don't want to be the only language used in this session, but today I do have some background material about how language operates and gets in the way of operating, and then I'll move on tomorrow to talk about its use in literature and myth, particularly contemporary pop culture. The gist of what I'm going to say today is that if you don't learn to use language, or if you don't watch out and use language, language will in turn use you. And to some extent, there's no way around it. The most careful user of language is in turn going to be used by his language. I like the idea that L. Pitcher has been presenting in some of his lectures, the concept that there is no such thing as a neutral tool. What you choose to use, in turn, uses and shapes you. If you decide to use a machine to do a job, to some extent, in order to use that machine, you must become a robot, you must become an extension of the machine. So that if the machine is an extension of you, you have been made into a part of that machine, too. There is no such thing as a neutral tool. You are used by what you use. And so you can't simply say, well, let's do this and let's do that, and it isn't going to change me, because it is. Language is one of those tools that uses you as much as you use it. I don't think I need to say much about the servant part of language. I think we all recognize how important language and human communication are. We would not be here at Holden. We would not be, in a very literal way, civilized. We would not have progress, such as it is, if it were not for language. Because language allows the human, almost alone among animals, although we're beginning to have doubts about that as we learn that other animals seem to have fairly complicated language systems. But humans alone can put words down on a page, and that allows them an incredible freedom that is denied to all the other animals. A dog, for instance, cannot really think about love unless the object of his love is there. He may be restless when his master is gone, but it's not the kind of restlessness in which he is thinking, oh, when is my master going to return? He is simply restless instinctively, because it's been programmed into him. He has no idea, apparently, of why he is restless. So that when the object isn't actually there, it literally isn't in the animal's world. But in moments when we are not actually engaged in loving other people, can read books about it, it can bring our memories back, and we can love in the privacy of our own rooms. We can remember somebody who has died in a way that animals simply can't. And it is language that has given us that kind of freedom, the symbols that language are. Furthermore, not only can we remember something that's absent, but we can transmit those memories on to future generations, so that each of us does not have to start over again and over again and over again learning the culture. Information can be transmitted, and that's why we're on the moon, rather than any other kind of animal. We can pass on, in other words, accumulated knowledge. We can store it. We can put it in those boxes that Erling Jorstad talked about. And I think also one real servant use of language is as a kind of verbal stroking. People love to talk to each other, need to talk to each other. And sometimes it doesn't make much difference what that talk is about. It's simply that two voices are reaching out to each other. I like to think, in fact, in a lot of ways, that one of the major uses of poetry and literature and art is not to communicate a message, do this and don't do that, or live this way and don't live that way, but that the poem is, as it were, almost an excuse or a bridge between two human voices. If I had discovered, for instance, that Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening had been written by a monkey sitting down at a typewriter, accidentally typing it out, and he even put the periods in the right place and all the punctuation, that poem still would not be. And if it were word for word identical to what Robert Frost wrote, that would not mean as much to me. I would find it interesting, but I wouldn't really think it was a great poem. I need to know that at the other end of that poem there's a human being who is talking to me. What he is saying is not quite so important as the fact that he is saying something, that we are reaching each other. A poem is a bridge as much as it is anything else. These are all the things that the servant language does for us. But what I'd like to talk about today, primarily, is things which get in the way of that process of communication, that create the spaces in our togetherness that we all inevitably have. Let me start out. I could not find an orange in the village, but I like to use an orange for this example. So you first of all are going to have to pretend that I'm holding an orange in my hand. And then once you've done that, the next leap of faith is not too much. You must believe that I have never tasted an orange in my life. How many of you have eaten an orange? You'll soon learn not to raise your hand. Okay, I'll pick on you because you have a bright yellow sweatshirt on this morning. Tell me what an orange tastes like. Is it good, bad, indifferent?
According to the orange.
It's what?
It's according to the orange.
Well, just orange in general.
Okay, it's sweet and yet...
Like tame. Sugar.
If it's a good Florida juice orange.
No commercials. Okay.
Has a certain zip to it. It may spray all over the person next to you if you're not careful.
Okay, I want to know what it tastes like,
tastes
though.
Like.
Yeah. It's sweet, you said, with a certain tang.
Mm-hmm.
Would if I added vinegar to sugar water, would I get the taste of an orange? What would I? Somebody can help her out. You can all help her out.
Gee, this is so common.
Wet.
Okay, it's wet.
A fruit taste.
What do you mean a fruit taste? Like apple, right?
Well, there. It has. Ascorbic acid, if you want to get technical.
Okay, so if I took sugar water and added ascorbic acid, would I get orange?
No.
Somebody over here, you said citrus, right? You're pretty close. I have tasted lemons and I've tasted grapefruits and kumquats and all kinds of things. How does it compare to a lemon?
Sweeter.
So if I took lemon and added sugar, I would get orange.
No, you get lemonade.
No. What?
You get lemonade.
Right. You don't need my lecture. Oh, I must remember not to use that example anymore. Okay, no, somebody compare it. We're close now. It's like a lemon, I guess, right? But how is it different?
It's larger, it's rounder.
It's the taste.
Taste.
I want to know whether I ought to eat an orange or not. Go ahead. Okay, like a lemon with sugar?
No, milder.
Not as like a watered down lemon.
No. It has an individual taste.
It tastes like nothing else.
What do you mean it tastes? There's. The, you mean you? Are you admitting defeat? If you do, I can go on.
It tastes like nothing else. It's got its own taste.
Okay, it has its own, I think that's a good place to end because I think, as you all realize now, that is literally true. An orange is an orange, and that's all it is. We could get close. I think if we properly pressed Herb to talk about oranges, pretty soon we'd all be dying for oranges and the village would have to ship down and order oranges for breakfast. But I don't think even Herb could actually tell me what an orange tastes like. Because the first thing that gets in the way in using words is that words are not the things themselves. We use words to replace the things so we don't have to carry the things around. Jonathan Swift suggested that to overcome the difficulties of language, you just carry all the things you want to talk about in a sack on your back and then take them out, desk, chair, and so forth. But that immediately gets cumbersome and limits your vocabulary. No, okay, so we have to use words. But in a way, they're necessary evils. They are not the things themselves. Is there anything you can communicate to anyone else, like the taste of an orange, which he hasn't himself, or she hasn't herself, first tasted. Can you really tell anybody anything they don't already know? And the answer, very literally, is no. This is a problem that I first came across when I was doing my dissertation on Jonathan Edwards, the Puritan minister who was involved in the Great Awakening in the 18th century. And the frustration that he felt by the fact, and one of the reasons that led him to a theology of predestination, and the rest of the Puritans, was this same kind of thing. You stand up there as a minister and talk about heaven and hell and God and angels, but unless the congregation has tasted those things, there is no way by which a preacher can tell you what it's like, any more than any of you can tell me what the taste of an orange is like. And so the frustration for Jonathan Edwards and for teachers and for all of us who communicate is, how do you do that? How do you tell somebody something that he doesn't already know? I suppose that the Pentecostals do have a point. That is, that unless you have been touched somehow by grace or by the Holy Spirit, words are not going to do the job. They can get close. They can, in the hands of the right people, make us want to taste. And that's finally what Jonathan Edwards arrived at. What you can do is make the congregation want to taste God by using analogies, by using pictures, by making it poetic and desirable. But there's no way in which you can actually communicate the taste of an orange, let alone the concept of freedom or love or all those abstractions that we're constantly confronted with. Words are not things. And specifically in the English language, not only are words not things, but they have no real relationship to things. You remember that standard old joke, why did Adam call an elephant? And the answer is because it looked more like an elephant than any other animal. But that's not true. Nobody really knows how language originated. There are several theories. There's the Bow Wow theory that suggests that these were attempts to imitate the actual sounds of the animals that have somehow, in the course of time, gotten changed around. But there are no real connections. The word D-E-S-K doesn't look or sound. It's not anywhere near the shape of the word or the actual thing, desk. So that when I use desk, when I tell you I am going to go and write on my desk, with 100 people, there are 100 different desks, because the desks you've experienced are the desks you see, not my desk at all. So there are always going to be, simply because of this problem in language that words aren't things, there are always going to be spaces in our togetherness. Some languages, of course, are more picture languages. The Hungarians, for instance, claim that a lot of words in their language are attempts to imitate the visual picture of things. I don't have a blackboard here, but the Hungarian word, what do you think the Hungarian word O-L-L-O is? Imagine that in your mind, O-L-L-O. What is that the word for?
A jug.
Scissors. Scissors, right? Isn't that neat?
It's a blackboard.
I'm through. I'll get back to it. No, O-L-L-O is scissors. But we don't really have any words like that, nor really do the Hungarians. And nobody, since nobody gets scissors, I guess it's not a very good picture of scissors at all anyway. Okay, first of all, because words are not things, they tend to get separated. You've all had the experience, I'm sure, of plodding through a textbook and reading just words. And you've also all had the experience, I hope, of reading a short story or a poem or a novel and suddenly discovering that 3 hours have passed and that you haven't even been aware that you've been reading. You have been right there. You were Hamlet. You were right in the Brothers Karamazov. You were a part of that book, so that you didn't realize you were reading the words. Okay, most of our communication, I think, takes place on the first level, that level in which all you're reading is words. I like Emerson here, And just let me go into him in a minute. Emerson had two phrases that I think are really apropos here. He says, all language is fossil poetry. All language is fossil poetry. And then another one that really says the same sort of thing. Every word was once a poem. What do you think he means by that? Every word was once a poem. Any suggestions?
Idea.
What do you mean, idea, Rich?
Well, I think a poem would be like trying to distill an idea in a kind of concise, orderly way, and the word would probably be the most concise symbol of that.
Sure, I think what Emerson has in mind is that a word doesn't really get in. People don't sit down and say, well, let's invent words for the next hour. They invent a word because there's a need, because they've seen somewhere a new, as Rich says, idea, or a new relationship between things, between something concrete and something abstract, and so they invent a word for it. And for a while, that word is really fresh, just as the words that come and go in our language and then suddenly get overused. Like relate or dialogue. Dialogue got beaten to death in 1970, and then you've got to invent a new word for it. Paul?
Are we defining a poem then as something fresh?
Sure, sure.
That's the definition of poem.
It's not really a poem, otherwise it's verse, right?
For poem.
What?
That's an alternative word we can use for poem.
I think
in
so.
We use the word fresh to mean spinach.
Yeah, but you belong to the Friendly Church in Santa Monica, Paul. I don't trust you.
But you know, when the children here in the village, because I watch them all growing up, get to be grandfathers, all of them, when they say moon, they've just created it.
That's right.
It's really something.
Listen to children talk, and they talk in poetry because their world is one of constantly new relationships. I can remember Randy when we were new in Rock Island. We were driving home, and he said, are you sure we're going the right way? Are you sure we're going the right way? And I said, yeah, I know where we're going. And he kept asking, and finally he said, just shook his head, and he saw the cars coming the other way. He said, look at all those cars going the wrong way. I wish I could have thought of that. Mary?
Poem is an idea. I think it's an image.
Well, I don't see any difference. No, I don't. It's an image. It's an image to which something is done. Let me give you Emerson's example. Emerson's example is the word inspire. Most of us know what the word inspire means. We know in a vague sort of way. We use it. We hear it used constantly. But Emerson's point is that's, for most of us, fossilized. We really don't. What does inspire mean? It originally meant to whoever first developed it to breathe in. That you've all had. You see a friend you haven't seen for 20 years. And totally unexpectedly, or something. You've been struggling with a problem. How does this work? How does this concept operate? And suddenly you see it, and that gasp of air, as you see it. That is. To inspire. Ah, the light bulb flashes. I see, but I breathe in. Okay, whoever first saw the relationship between that act of breathing in and spiritual inspiration really made a relationship, saw an idea, put an image with something that gave that image meaning. But shortly, we all start using it, and by the time it gets down to us, it's no longer a symbol, it's just a sign. It has no real meaning for us unless it gets in the hands of a poet. And once it does that, it's up to the poet to break the language out of the fossil, to renew it, to make it new again. Not only poetry, but that's where it's at for all of us. Let me give you some examples for Cummings, who's been called a master of the renewal of the cliché, because I think he's particularly good at it. Cummings will take a phrase that is the most ordinary kind of phrase, and by shifting a word will suddenly make you pay attention to it, will make it new again, will make it a poem. He has one poem, one of my favorites, that changes just one word in an otherwise incredibly tired sentence. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day. Now, he could have put most, English teachers would have permitted him to put most, in all sorts of other places. I thank you most, God, for this amazing day. I thank you for this most amazing day. I thank you for this amazing day most. But we all put most there. Cummings puts it in the one place where it doesn't fit, and suddenly there's no more fossil, there's poetry. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day. The most enters every other word there. God, day, amazing. It does service to all of those. Now, that's a neat little trick on Cummings' part, but it opens that whole phrase up again and makes it new. I particularly like Cummings' phrase about his mother. And I worked that into, if you've heard me before this summer, I worked that into every lecture. Whatever the topic is, I work this sentence in because I like it so much. Cummings, in talking about his mother, says she kept her sense of humor up to the very beginning. Now, you expect end there, and your first reaction probably is, geez, that's obscure poetry. Oh, is that weird? Is that strange? What does he mean? But then you begin to think about it, if you're with him, and suddenly, up to the very end, that old cliche, that old fossil, is broken open, and some new relationship between life and death, and between Cummings and his mother, enter in. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day. My mother kept her sense of humor up to the very beginning. Those are beautiful ways by which language becomes one with the thing again and lets the word speak. That's, I think, essentially what poetry is. Most of us, however, use language in the most tired way possible. We say fluffy clouds. We say busy as a bee or high as a kite. We use images whose use has long since disappeared. Keep your irons in the fire. How many of you have ever seen irons in the fire or know what irons in the fire are? How can that phrase possibly mean anything to you except just talk? Teetotaler. How many of you really know what a teetotaler is? You know it's somebody that abstains from alcohol, but I'm sure that most of you don't know that that was during the 19th century movement against alcohol, that various groups disagreed on whether they ought to have beer or not, some groups permitting beer and other groups permitting absolutely no alcoholic beverages, and though the groups that permitted nothing at all bore a big T on their cards, standing for total abstinence, and they came to be known as teetotalers. Well, almost anything, you could take half the language you use every day, and I think if you were pressed, and if I were pressed, we would have to say, I really don't know what it means. I've just used it because somebody else has used it. I've said busy as a bee or quiet as a mouse. Those things were, quiet as a mouse is great. I mean, mouse is incredibly quiet. But somebody else said it first, and the minute you use it, and the minute somebody else hears you use it, it's dead. Furthermore, the minute you say fluffy clouds and busy as a bee and high as a kite, you are letting somebody else do your thinking for you. You are not seeing the moon in the way a child sees the moon, or driving in the city the way a child sees driving in the city. You're part of that language has controlled you rather than letting you control the language. Furthermore, and now I give you a little quiz every so often just to see how things are going. Furthermore, because words are not things, the very pattern of the language helps shape how and what you think. Let me try this little test on you. If you have done this before, you can be quiet. I need some response on this. I want you to give the answers to the last word in my sentence. For instance, when I say a funny story is called a joke, you say joke, right? Let's try that. A funny story is called a
joke.
Right, okay. A hit in the mouth is called a poke. Okay, now let's try those two. A funny story is called a
joke.
A hit in the mouth is called a
joke.
Great. Okay. A cigarette is called a smoke. Let's try those three. A funny story is called a
joke.
A hit in the mouth is called a
joke.
A cigarette is called a
smoke.
Okay. Now let's try it again just a little faster, and I'm going to add something to it. A funny story is called a
joke.
A hit in the mouth is called a
joke.
A cigarette is called a
joke.
The white of an egg is called a
joke.
No, it isn't. Okay, if I, it worked. If it hadn't worked, I would have had an M. What I've done, I suppose, is what the psychologists would call putting you in set, that is, getting you into a rut. You see how easy it is to get a human being into a rut. Why did you say yolk? I did not tell you the word had to rhyme, but even giving you three rhyming words in a row, you have begun to adopt a pattern which ended up controlling you rather than letting yourself be on top of it. And isn't that true in so many ways? For instance, we like to think in terms of three. A story has to have a sermon, a lecture has to have a beginning, middle, and an end, right? Even though life doesn't have necessarily a beginning, middle, and end. We have to have three parts. I will discuss three topics. Even though, have you ever heard anybody discuss two topics or four? Okay, now isn't it conceivable that occasionally life has one topic or two topics or four or eight or in my case 15? I've got down here. Why always three? Because we have let language condition us, and I think if you sit down to write a sermon or a lecture, you first of all begin to think what's going to fit into three parts, and then you warp life to fit those three parts. That's one of the reasons I like Carol's collage sermons that don't really begin anywhere and don't really end anywhere, but somehow, you know, life really comes through them. They are a happening. And that, again, is what a poem is trying to get across, the way in which language patterns us. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Maybe there's a fourth thing, right? But we're so tied into threes because of our training in school that it's just hard to get away from. Okay, furthermore, one of the other difficulties, because words are not things, is that language is in a constant process of change. It's never the same twice. There's a generation gap, not only because children think differently from their parents, but because, in a very real sense, their language is also different. Okay, it's time for grammar quiz. It is I or me? Why? Who said me? What? Oh, we got you, an English teacher?
Yes.
Okay. I won't tell if you won't. Okay. It should be I, you would say?
Yes.
If a student wrote me, would you grade it wrong?
Not so much now as I would have 10 years ago.
Why is that?
Commonly used. And poetic license, I suppose.
And because English teachers have just given up, right? I know the real reason, because I'm an English teacher, too. No, why did you all say I? And I have never heard in 3.5 weeks in the village anybody say it is I. You've all said me. I mean, don't kid me. I've listened to you talk. Why should it be it is I? Do you want to give the...
Oh, no.
Okay. Well, the fact is that most college texts now say it should be me and not I, that I is wrong. Why is I wrong? Can you imagine a guy in a dorm calling a girl up for a date, or even here at Holden Village, and she comes to the phone and she says, hello, this is she, or it is I? What would that guy's reaction be? You know, well, I may go through with the night, but it's a mistake already, right? Whereas if she says, hi, it's me, she has communicated her warmth, her eagerness, her desire. she's communicated much more about herself, a much better self, rather than if she'd said, "It is I." And on that basis, the college texts today say, "Me is right." In most situations, unless you're talking to an English teacher or to anybody over 70. Mary?
Okay,
what's the past tense of hang? H-A-N-G. Okay, is it hanged or hung? Both? Yes, it is. You mean you could use them indiscriminately?
No.
Okay, clothes are hung, people are hanged. Right? There is a word, a verb in the process of shifting to a regular verb. It always used to be hung, but it is, and probably in 20 years it's all going to be hanged, but it's a word that is in process now of changing. The language is constantly changing. We are members, English is a member of the Indo-European family of languages, a race of people who left absolutely no record except by the language that we can trace back that we share in common. Indo-European because Sanskrit is a sister tongue to English, as are Greek and Latin and German and French and all the Scandinavian languages. We're much closer, we're first cousins to the Scandinavian languages, but all these languages that I just mentioned were once one language. Each has gone its own way, has developed its own vocabulary, to the point where even German today, or even Norwegian, is a totally foreign language to somebody speaking in English, except for the few words that you can pick out. The same thing is true with French. Only those few core words that everybody used every day, way back from Indo-European times, the words associated with family and house are the same. So that the word for brother in English is Bruder in German and in the Scandinavian languages, and way over in India in Sanskrit, it's also brother. The word for mother in Sanskrit is identical virtually to the English word for mother. But most of our vocabulary is just totally, totally changed. The old controversies that English teachers used to get really uptight about, shall and will, all of that has really disappeared. There is no shall in that sense in the language anymore, virtually. Some words have completely changed their meanings over the course of time. What's a gossip? Don't say person, it's a woman, I know. who talks over the back fence with her neighbor. What does gossip really mean? Does anybody know? What words does it come from?
God and sibling.
God and sibling. That is, it was once a godparent, a godmother. Somehow that word, when it entered the language, had all the positive connotations, and today it has all the negative connotations. To be a nice girl in Anglo-Saxon England meant to be a prostitute. In the 1920s, it was nice to be nice, and today, no nice girl really wants to be called a nice girl because it's starting to have super sweet, syrupy connotations again. The word nice has just gone all through all sorts of shifts, all the way down through time. These shifts are not centuries long in the making. What was hot in the 1950s is cool today, apparently. And so it's literally true that my sons speak a different language from the one I speak, and communication between us is more difficult because of that. The language change seems to be a process that you can't stop either. It seems to be just an ongoing kind of thing. Two countries, France and Norway, have tried to arbitrate language. 50 years ago, the Norwegian, I don't know what group it is in Norway, but it's the French Academy in France 100 years ago, simply said, this word is going to mean this from now on, period. We are not going to have all this constant silly shifting and changing around. And the result in both France and Norway is that there are literally two languages. If you have ever had the task of learning French in college. You have learned book French and have been astounded, I'm sure, to go to France and try to communicate in that French language with the French people, because it's different. And the same thing is true with Norway. People like my father-in-law, who emigrated or who spoke Norwegian when they were born and were almost fresh from Norway, going back to Norway, find that they can still read Norwegian newspapers, particularly ones printed in Decorah, Iowa. But to go back and try to communicate with living Norwegians, speaking the Norwegian language, is another thing. So that apparently the result of any kind of trying to stop this rapid turmoil and shift of language is that you end up with two languages. One official, artsy, and very artificial language that's used by literature and government, and another, the real changing, bubbling language of people that is always ongoing, always changing. Language changes, and that's another thing that gets in the way of communication. A friend of mine at graduate school in English wrote a dissertation on a passage in Romeo and Juliet in which we are told after that famous balcony scene that Juliet retired to her chamber and Romeo went apart and watched the whole night. Well, what did he watch? You know, you can make all kinds of things out of that, right? Except that had he only bothered to check the Oxford English Dictionary, which gives you all the meanings all the way back to the first introduction into the English language of a word, had he only bothered to check, he would have discovered that watched into Shakespeare simply meant to stay awake. He did not mean to look or to see or to peep or anything like that. That's a meaning that we've added on since then. An even more serious problem, however, with language that really gets in the way of communication is that language is not only communication, but it is cultural and social. It's a cultural and social tool by which we put ourselves below or above other people, by which we bring other groups into line and do all kinds of things that language was never originally intended to do. Next time you're on a plane or a bus, try this experiment if you have the stomach to do it. If the person next to you says, "What do? Tell them, "I teach English." And watch him, you know, dive out the plane. Or or at least move as far as he can toward the window and spend the next 2 hours staring out the window. If he doesn't do that, or before he does that, he will probably say, and I'm sure you've had that same experience, he will probably say, "Well, I guess I better watch my language." Or, "I never was very good at English. I should have really studied English more when I was in school." Nobody says that to a chemistry teacher or a physics teacher. Nobody says, "Oh, I better watch my physics." Or if you meet a physics teacher, what does the person say? He says, "You know, I've always wondered how this works. Can you tell me? Can you help me? Can you explain this?" Or a chemistry or biology teacher, "What makes certain animals disappear?" And you get into a lively conversation because the guy is full of questions about how things work and how things operate. But the fact is, you see, English teachers are not really teachers. We're policemen. We have been, at least, until we, 10 years ago, started giving it up and saying, "I don't want to, you know, pay any attention to that." We are literally policemen. We have decided what is good for people to read and not good for people to read. And the result of that is that a survey taken in 1970 pointed out, or showed, of high school seniors, showed that the most hated book in the English language is Silas Marner. Now, Silas Marner is a great book. It's not a great book to read in 9th or 10th or 11th grade. It's a great book to read when you've grown up to the point where you don't need plot, action, and sex. But it is not good. Okay, why have we decided that you must read either Othello or King Lear? There's been a little debate among English teachers on that. Silas Marner and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Until in the early 60s we began to give this up. Literally, it's because we use language, and this is, I think, the most damaging of all the things we do. We use language to to non-communicate, to separate rather than to bring together. Most communication, most of the things we teach our kids, unless we really are our exceptional parents, and most of the things I'm afraid that English teachers and other teachers have taught school children in the educational system, is not to open up communication, but to shut it off. That is, to give the right answers, which are the teacher's answers, to say it in the teacher's way, to write the way the teacher wants to write. We had some, 5 or 6 years ago, a group of students from CAM, Christian Action Ministry Academy in Chicago, who were high school dropouts who had taken the alternate education route and wanted to desperately get back in and get on with higher education. We got 5 of them at Augustana, and I took a class just of those 5 for freshman English. And the first day, because I was really uptight, I didn't know, you know, how to approach them at all, I said, why don't you write me a little essay about what your writing problems are? And I'll never forget what one guy wrote was, I write too strong. And we got into a discussion about that the next period. And what he really meant was that he tells it like it is, and that the teachers don't want him to say that. You know, he says begin or start, and they want commence. you know, that's another thing. There's an interesting shift here between, if you've gone to school 100 years ago and were a product of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address type of rhetoric, you would have literally been taught to use commence instead of begin, because it proved that you were a gentleman, proved that you were civilized, and proved that you were cultured. That is, that you used the French imports into the language and not the you would have been taught to use people rather than folk, or mansion or cottage rather than shack or house, which are the Anglo-Saxon part words. But we really made an amazing shift, I think, in the last 15 years, and today English teachers are teaching, don't ever say commence, don't ever say you dwell someplace, you just live there. Most people don't dwell anymore, they just live places. Besides which, when you're sinking and drowning, you don't shout aid, aid, do you? you shout help, help, which is the Anglo-Saxon word. So I'm glad to see we're coming back to a kind of, you know, groundwork thing. But let me get back to the question of communication being non-communication. Let me give you an example that all of you have used. When you meet somebody, either at Holden Village or somewhere else, and you say, good morning, how are you? What's the last thing you want to know? How they are. What would happen if somebody started unloading his problems on you as a result of that? That is, really took you literally and thinking you wanted to open communication. You would be horrified. I had 2 students that hollowed out a book and put a tape recorder. 2 freshmen did this as an experiment last quarter. And they went around on the campus, Augustana, the Friendly College, and so forth, and they wanted to see whether freshmen were more open than seniors, but they found that everybody was really all shut up tight. They would wait for somebody to say, hi, how are you? And they would say, well, I've got a real problem. I'm trying to decide whether to put my grandmother in old people's home or to try to keep her at home, and I don't know what to do. And you would be, no, you probably wouldn't be astounded at the answers they got. Oh, is that right? Well, I got to go fix my car. You know? Nobody reached out. Nobody opened themselves and said, let's have a cup of coffee and talk about it. People said they were sorry, but boy, it was clear that was a nervous sorry, and they really got out of there fast. I think that another assignment that I give my students, most of whom refuse to do it, which leads to a good discussion, is the very first week of class. They're all new freshmen. They really, you know, they've all seen people of the opposite sex they really would like to get to know, that they really admire. I say, okay, your next assignment is to go up to somebody that you have not met yet or even talked to and compliment him. Doesn't have to be that he's got a great bod. Or anything like that. It can just be, I really like the way you talk, or just something nice. And they cannot do it. Nor could I suppose. Because we have all been taught non-communication rather than communication. They simply cannot do it. Or if they do it, they'll say, you know, I've spent this week looking around, and I really like the way you dress. I'm just doing this for an English class. so we get into a discussion of what will happen. You know, what could possibly happen except you're really going to make some guy or girl's day great if you compliment them. No, we're going to get in trouble. They're going to think I'm really kind of weird. It's just absolutely incredible. But we're all in that bind because we have let language control us. It's cultural. It's not really communicative at all. This leads into all kinds of problems in teaching alternate English styles. Should we teach getaways? Should I teach that boy who speaks too strong? And it's true that if he wants to get a job in a white society, if he wants to get along with white professors and with white students, he probably is going to have to learn to water, literally, to water that language down and speak in the cliches that all of us speak in. But do I really want to do that to him? Shouldn't I rather try to get other people to speak more strongly? But that's not going to happen. Should we teach getaways? What should we do with these CAM students? We get 5 of them a year. Should we encourage them to speak in that vibrant and alive and strong way they speak, which turns other people off? Or should we say, well, let's face it, you're going to have to learn the system. You're going to have to learn the cultural uses of language and simply give up that getaways. I can understand getaways. Most of the problems with English are not grammar problems. What's wrong? Let me give you another grammar quiz. What's wrong with I ain't got no, let me not stick ain't in there. Ain't is dead forever. I haven't got no bananas. Well, what's wrong with the double negative?
Double negative. You mean yes.
It makes a positive.
Two negatives make a positive? Mm-hmm. Well, how did Shakespeare and Chaucer get by with it? What happened, you see, in the 18th century was that science got invented. Developed. And the result of that was that we didn't have an English grammar. You could spell anything any way you wanted, depending on the if you didn't have two E's left in the typeface, you could use one, or you could use caps or use U's in place of B's and so forth. But in the 18th century, Samuel Johnson and others said, wait a minute, we got to get systematic about language, which meant we got to get scientific about it. And because in algebra, two negatives make a positive, we suddenly decided that the same thing is true with English language. Two negatives make a positive. So, I haven't got no bananas really means you do. Well, do you think that anybody would ever, if a grocery store clerk said, I haven't got no bananas, would you say, fine, give me 2 pounds? No, you wouldn't at all. There's no way in which you're going to mistake that. Shakespeare and Chaucer use the double negative to give a double emphasis. What that grocery store clerk means is he really ain't got no bananas. He is using strong language. But you see, that's dead forever because of us policemen who simply arbitrarily said, bang, you can't do that. So there are all kinds of silly things that got tied up with language and with language teaching that have nothing to do with communication at all, but which in fact really get away and get in the way of communication. Let me go on to just one final thing. Not only in this cultural and social bit, we are really limited by the vocabulary that our culture permits us to use. And let me take, I suppose, the most striking example in our culture. One of the difficulties that writers like D.H. Lawrence and C.S. Lewis and others had when it came to write of human sexuality is that there is no set of words in the English language which describe sex as the meaningful, mind-expanding, beautiful thing that it really is. What set of words can you use? The fact is we have 3 sets of words, all of them way off base, 3 complete sets of words. We have a set that your kids all learn in the schoolyard, which I suppose most of us would consider obscene or pornographic. The words for sex written on bathroom walls. not only, and I'm not concerned that these are obscene, but all of these words, if you think about them, and I'm sure you all know some, all of these words imply a kind of violence and perversion of what sex really is. Let me just give you one example. The most common word, I suppose, in this set of words for intercourse is screw. Screw, before it came to be associated with sex, was a term that prisoners used for a particularly brutal kind of prison guard that beat the prisoners to bloody pulps. That was known as a screw, and it still is if you, you know, have ever been in prison and talked about your jailers. Ditto all the other hundreds of words in this category that get on the bathroom walls. They all imply sex as something filthy and violent and perverted, in which the woman is nothing more than a subject, in which the man is simply an overpowering and violent beast. Okay, that is a set way off base, but it's the one the kids first learn, usually. Then the schools counter this by a clinical set, in which we have all sorts of clinical words. You can toss these all around, you can describe everything in beautiful, clinical, but absolutely cold and passionless and silly-sounding words. Now, to talk about sex in clinical terms, is that it? No. Then, for people who are uptight about sex, we have a beautiful hearts and flowers set of words. Make love, you see, and so forth and so on. And we can describe it in rose-covered cottage, live happily ever after kinds of terms. It doesn't do good to mix those together. You can't use one paragraph of pornography, another paragraph of clinical, and then end up with the hearts and flowers. We literally have no set of words in the English language to make sex beautiful. What do you think that does to a child growing up in our culture? Control, literally controlled in what he learns about sex, except by example of parents and those around him. But language is totally powerless. In fact, is evil when it comes to raising our children in our culture and teaching them what sex is all about. It is no wonder that we have the hang-ups that we have. Furthermore, we have only one word for love, and we use that to love our automobiles and love God and lust after women. The Greeks have three, eros, agape, and philios, for three quite different kinds of love. And it must do something to us to love our toaster in the same way that we love God. No, that's not all the same kind of love. And we don't have ways to distinguish it, unless we happen to have a poet who can take that word and ring changes out of it. Most of us don't have time to do that. Paul?
The problem is, as you so ably stated from the beginning, how do you describe an orange?
Well, since I don't have an answer to that, Paul, what do you recommend?
I have no recommendation.
Okay, it's time for coffee break. Fortunately, okay, I will.
There you do have, you know, Abraham playing with Sarah, sporting with her. You do have the one word for the knowledge of God, and the sex acts, or as the scriptures can speak to us there. And that's a lot of people forget. The same word for God is for the sex act in the Hebrew language, yada. A culture like that couldn't have our hang-up.
I think that's right, Carol. I think language is part of our fallen world, and it's a fallen instrument, and it desperately needs grace, the taste of the orange itself, before we can even get off the ground. Okay, I'll tomorrow then go on with some other things and end up with...